Okay, so welcome everyone to the live podcast for the Society of Addiction Psychology. Today we are lucky to have Dr. Kristen Lindgren join us, who's a faculty at UW, and she does some really interesting things related to identity and drinking specifically. And so we're eager to hear about her research and about navigating the complicated career structure of achieving and landing grants and so forth. So, Dr. Lindgren, if you would please just kind of introduce yourself, a little bit about where you are, so forth and so on.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. And thanks, Noah and Dave, for the opportunity to be here. It's really an honor, and I'm excited to hear what kinds of questions you guys have and how I can be helpful, whether in terms of the research piece that I'll tell you about a little bit later or career development issues or both. So as Noah said, I am an associate professor at the University of Washington. I'm in the psychiatry department, so I am navigating the world of soft money. I also am a clinical psychologist by training, and so I'll spend a bit of my time doing clinical practice, so direct service through UW, and also do some teaching, and I'll tell you a little bit about that as we get started with the talk. I guess other things that I should tell you, I'm a relatively late bloomer when it comes to being an addictions researcher. As a graduate student, I was also at the University of Washington, and at the time was really focusing on issues related to sexual assault and sexual risk-taking. I was cross-training in clinical and social personality psychology. And my advisor, Bill George, did plenty of work in alcohol and alcohol research, and I famously swore in a lab meeting that I would never have anything to do with this and would never, ever, ever do an alcohol administration study, and ate my words about 2 years ago when, in fact, that's exactly what I started doing with an alcohol administration study, and my transition to alcohol happened earlier than that. Just some of the things to kind of put out there for folks who might have questions or be kind of considering different shifts and interests and whatnot. It can be done. It is done all the time. And for many of us, although we can tell our stories like they're real nice and linear, they're mostly not. And what humans are remarkably good at is, in fact, you know, constructing stories that make sense about how we got where we are. So I'll tell you a story later that's mostly chronologically accurate. But to say that I knew from the get-go that I was going to end up in addiction psychology with an emphasis on identity and alcohol, that is absolutely not where I thought I would start in any way, shape, or form.
I think those are some of the greatest stories, though. I think some of the greatest discoveries that have ever been made have kind of just kind of happened along the way. I'm a big fan of your work, so I'm really eager to hear more about it. So, whenever you're ready, you're welcome to launch in. We can take it multiple different ways. Oftentimes, what we'll do is we'll just kind of go through the talk, and then if you want to stop at various transition points that make sense for you, we can have the audience ask questions. Or we can have them ask questions as we go along, whatever makes you most comfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to do it anyway. As somebody who was originally from the East Coast and now out on the West Coast, I've become way more laid back these days. From the get-go, please, please, please call me Kristen. I'm not sure who Dr. Lindgren is, but she's not on the call today. So I would prefer definitely that. If there's a question that you want to ask us, we're going, happy to do it. And if it makes more sense to wait to the end, I'm happy to do that either. What I'd also say is, for me, this is the first time of doing a talk without any kind of visuals. So I would definitely say if there's anything that's confusing or tricky and you have no idea what I'm saying, please, please, please interrupt. This is such a waste of everyone's time if I make it no sense. Does that sound like an okay plan?
Sounds good.
I'm on board. Sounds good to me as well.
Great, great. Well, what I thought I'd do today, because I was really excited by the opportunity to get to talk to you both about the research and then also talk a little bit about some of the career development pieces, was to take some time to tell you a little bit about who I am in a slightly more structured way, talk a little bit more about some of the overarching values that increasingly kind of frame the questions that I ask and guide what I do, tell you a little bit about big findings that have kind of marked the research that I've done over, let's say, the last 7 or 8 years, and then take some time for questions at the end. And what I should say with all of this, although you'll commonly hear me talking about what I did or what we did in my lab, what that's leaving out for the purposes of brevity and simplicity are all of the trainees and collaborators, wonderful, wonderful, incredible research coordinators, some of whom are on the call right now. Glad to have you guys with us. And all the former mentors who really shape the kinds of questions that I'm asking. And also, as Noah noted, I am soft money funded, and so I'm very grateful to NIAAA, who's funded my research essentially since 2006 when I started on a T32 that's funded by NIAAA. So kind of starting with the very beginning, I did think it might be helpful to tell you a little bit about who I am and what I do. And when I stop and think about it and really reflect about what I do, what I think about at the end of the day is that I'm a teacher. And to really know me, you got to know a little bit about who my very first teachers were. And they were my parents, and they were both public school teachers. My dad was a high school science teacher. My mom was a middle school English and reading teacher. And what I learned from them was how to be a good teacher. And specifically what I saw them doing, and quite frankly, I probably wasn't aware of this at the time, but as I got older and could put this into context, was that I saw that they could attend to both the fine details, so things like, you know, the parts of speech in a sentence, are you using the correct constant in some kind of an equation, but they also attended to the big picture. So asking questions like, what are you trying to actually say in this sentence or paragraph, or what does this result actually tell you about gravity or different forces that literally are affecting our world? And what I saw them do, and I had the pleasure actually of having my dad as a classroom teacher, is I saw them kind of constantly moving back and forth between these different levels of inquiry when they were working with their own students or when they were working with my sister and me at home. And it made them really, really effective teachers. As I got older and was able to put more words to what that process is when you're moving between those different levels of analysis, what I really started to understand is that this is, in essence, right, a dialectic, that you got to have both detailed knowledge and you also have to be cognizant of the big picture. And so for me, a lot of the things that I'm trying to keep in mind in my own work, and it certainly informs my teaching, my clinical work, and my research, is to be able to move back and forth between big picture and small picture. When I think about, and one of the things I wanted to do, we'll see how effective this is or not, in terms of thinking about some professional development topics to highlight, I think it is important, and I guess one bit of wisdom, I guess we'll put that in quotes, we'll see how wise it actually is, but really this idea of learning from early mentors, even when, and I would say even especially when they're not in your own field, because there are often these nuggets that you take and that will really inform and shape who you are and how important it is to hold on to that and not let go of that. The other thing I thought I'd tell you a little bit about in order to get to know me and have a bit more of a background are the different kind of roles that I play and the different kind of work that I do. As Noah said previously, I'm in the psychiatry department at the University of Washington. I'm a clinical psychologist there, and I've got essentially three roles, all of which are multidisciplinary. I am, in fact, a teacher. I do some traditional classroom teaching. These days, my students are largely psychiatry residents. But I also provide group and individual clinical supervision, and I provide consultation to providers who are using evidence-based treatments in a variety of different settings. I'm also a practicing clinician. I'm an attending psychologist at our psychiatric outpatient clinic through the University of Washington. And I work with lots of other kinds of providers. I work with MDs. I work with nurses, physician's assistants, both in our clinic and in other departments. And likely most relevant to this podcast, I'm a researcher. I do have an active portfolio of grant-funded research. The majority of my work focuses on cognitive mechanisms that underlie substance abuse and use, most typically in the domain of alcohol research. And I also have an emerging trajectory of research that's focused on adaptation and implementation of evidence-based treatments for trauma-exposed populations. I'm not going to talk about that today in the talk that I do, but I'm more than happy to answer questions if folks are interested in that. And so, you know, another kind of professional development point that I do want to highlight for those of you who are particularly early in your careers, whether you're graduate, student, postdoc, is to highlight that it really is possible to have jobs when you're getting to do multiple roles if that's something that you're passionate about. I never would have thought that I would have been able to be a teacher within an academic psychiatry department, and yet that has in fact been possible. And so I think just kind of keeping your eye out for different types of opportunities and being open to that, if these different kinds of roles are important to you, it can happen. Pulling back a second to these different kinds of roles that I have, right, so being a teacher, being a researcher and clinician, one of the things that's really come up for me quite a bit is an awareness, and I say quite a bit, it has come up to me tremendously, are the gaps that we have in substance abuse treatment and mental health care. As the majority of you likely know, based on the kinds of questions, right, that you're interested in, what you know about the field, we have an incredible gap between the amount of people who need care and the amount of people who actually receive care. That's absolutely true globally, right? So when we look in terms of a global statistics, more than 78% of individuals with some kind of an alcohol use disorder do not receive treatment. And that gap absolutely persists in the United States. Again, I can't imagine that this is big news to any of you, but I do think it's really important to highlight about what the stakes are for us, that we don't have and we're never going to have enough providers to provide one-on-one therapy. And folks like Alan Kasdan have written very convincingly about this. We also know that most of the substance abuse and mental health care treatment that people receive in the United States isn't evidence-based. A lot of it happens in primary care where providers don't typically have any kind of specialized training. And so we've got tremendous disparities in the quality of and the access to care that people get. If we dig even deeper, right, and we look at substance use disorders and some of the recent reports from the Surgeon General, the costs associated with substance use disorders, I mean, are just absolutely staggering. When we see things like, you know, upwards of $200 billion a year, so $249 billion a year, I think was the most recent statistic I saw, in terms of the impact of alcohol misuse and alcohol use disorders, close to $200 billion when it comes to illicit substances. And I think the thing that really struck things home for me, as somebody who's, although I transitioned to alcohol research, I've been in the field for a while now, really putting into context that when we're looking at the rates of substance use disorders, right, 8% of individuals a year, what brought it home for me in a really big way is that these rates are comparable to the numbers of folks who are suffering from diabetes and 1.5 times larger than the annual prevalence rates of cancer, right? And so then with this, we get this treatment gap where, what is it, about 10% of folks with substance use disorders actually get specialty treatment. So we got big problems that we need to address and be working on. And so what I'm going to do in the next, you know, 25 minutes or so is to highlight one line of my research that's looking or seeking to make inroads into part of this gap. You know, and my hope for the work that I'm doing in identity is that it ultimately will help us in some way bridge the gap for substance use and substance abuse and the problems associated with it. So this work that I'm going to be telling you about really focuses on cognitive factors and hazardous drinking. It definitely is a line of research that for me takes a bottom-up approach. We're really starting with a risk factor, and where my research is headed is really blowing this out to, is this something, this risk factor, something we can ultimately target in treatment and create treatments that are novel or improve existing treatments as a way to give us additional ways that we might be able to reduce that gap. What I would say throughout is that I'm really interested in these questions of mechanisms of change and whether or not these cognitive factors might represent mechanisms of change, and really trying to be pragmatic throughout and ask questions, you know, because the stakes are high. Are these risk factors actually new or different? Can we actually bring this into treatment? Because that's really what we got to do at the end of the day. Okay. So where I'm going to start with this is tell you a little bit about a theoretical model that I saw when I was making this transition to alcohol research, and I was receiving training on the T32 on alcohol research at the University of Washington. And the particular model that I was looking at was a so-called dual process model of substance use and substance misuse. And this is a model that's been around for a long time, but for me it was the first time that I was seeing it back in about 2006-2007. And what this model is it's a heuristic, right? It's been criticized in a bunch of different ways, but I think it's still a really useful starting point because what it does is it talks about two different types of cognitive factors that may be important for predicting a number of different kinds of risky behaviors, including drinking. And what this model does is it identifies and focuses on so-called explicit cognitive processes. And these are cognitive processes that we think are reflective, they're introspective, they're controlled, they're slower. So those are the kinds of processes where we stop and we think deeply about something. But what these dual process models also do is they include a consideration of another kind of process that is more reflexive, more impulsive, more automatic, that's fast. And these kinds of processes are commonly referred to as implicit cognitive processes. Part of what got me really hooked on this kind of a model was from my early research in graduate school where I was doing this cross-training and focusing on sexual risk-taking. I did a lot of work with so-called implicit measures and implicit processes, and it just frankly hadn't even occurred to me that anybody was thinking about it in alcohol. Of course they would be, and of course they have been for a long time. This is, you know, again, reflecting my switch there, but it got me hooked because I really wanted to know more about this and understand how substance use researchers were thinking about implicit processes and thinking about this dual process application to substance use and abuse. So as I started looking into this kind of a model, I started getting really curious and wanting to know about the implicit side, and so wanting to know about these implicit cognitions related to alcohol, and wanted to get a sense of what had been done with that and where the field was looking. And so again, at the time we're looking like 2006, 2008, the field of thinking about implicit alcohol processes was still relatively young at that time. But despite that, what I noticed was that people were thinking about lots of different kinds of cognitions and using these implicit measures to assess cognitions related to alcohol. So they were thinking about things like alcohol and valence. So do you think alcohol is good or bad? So alcohol positive or negative. People were thinking about implicit processes in alcohol in terms of appetitive inclinations. So do you approach or avoid alcohol? People were thinking about implicit proxies for alcohol in terms of things like motives. So alcohol and drinking motives that you may think about, those of you with alcohol in your background. So things like alcohol and coping or alcohol and enhancement. People were also thinking about these questions about physiological arousal and alcohol. So does alcohol, does it kind of lead to this feeling of excitement, or does it kind of stimulate the body versus does it dampen the body? So what I noticed in essence, kind of pulling this all together, was that a lot of different implicit alcohol cognitions were being studied. They seemed to be drawn from a variety of different theories of thinking of drinking. And so it seemed like, you know, despite the field being relatively young, we were in pretty good shape. But here's kind of the thing that got brought to my attention. And it happened when I started my first academic job, which was at the University of Richmond. So I went from postdoc to being at the University of Richmond, which is a liberal arts college, lots and lots of wonderful students, many of whom have gone on into addiction fields in all kinds of ways. And you get really lucky when you're on faculty there and you have these really smart students in your lab. And what happened when I was sitting in my lab and continuing to really think about this question of implicit alcohol cognitions and implicit processes in drinking and really thinking, you know, are there any places to really make a contribution, or what might that contribution look like? A student in my lab at the time literally kind of shook his head in disgust and was like, you researchers are just missing something. And he just kind of stopped me on my tracks when he talked about it. And what he went on to say was, he talked about, from his point of view, that it seemed like on college campuses, there was a real fundamental difference between people who thought of themselves as drinkers and people who didn't think of themselves as drinkers. And he went on to say that he didn't think that identity necessarily corresponded one-to-one with I drink or I don't drink at all, but more about the importance of drinking to the person's experience. It made a ton of sense, and it was really interesting in this lab meeting, you know, kind of watching other students sitting around that table, conference table, nodding their head in agreement with it. And it really seemed interesting, and it seemed worth checking out. And so to start, one of the very first things we did is we went back to the literature. So one professional development point that I want to highlight right here is how important it is to listen to your students and to listen to ideas from people around you at whatever level. This particular student was a junior. He had no previous experience working in the lab. He had no previous experience in psychology research, let alone addictive behaviors or addictive science. I suspect he may have had some personal experience with drinking, but when it came to the research end, you know, this really was a new thing. And it's really important that we stopped and listened to him, because as we went back and when we dug into the literature and really looked at these dual process models and looked at whether or not people were thinking about self or identity in drinking, we didn't find that people were doing it when they were thinking about reflective or controlled processes, those more explicit processes in drinking. And we certainly didn't see it in the implicit side of the literature as well. So what it really seemed is that identity and self-related questions related to drinking really were missing from these dual process model considerations of drinking. It got us really excited, and what we started doing at that time in my lab was figuring out how we might go about measuring this idea of thinking about yourself as a drinker, or how you associate yourself with drinking. One of the places where we started was to develop a variant of the implicit association test, or the IAT. The IAT was developed by one of my mentors and graduate student, Tony Greenwald. And we started with that and using that because it has strong psychometrics for an implicit measure. And one of the things that we did in the way that an IAT works is that you have these series of categories that you look at as a way to assess the relationships between different categories. So when people in IAT research think about measuring associations with the self, that's been done and has been done for a long time. People use these categories of me and often not me on that end, so that was pretty straightforward. And then what you also do with an IAT is you need attribute categories. And so we were really interested in this idea of what about the relationship between the self and drinking. So we looked at these attributes of being a drinker or a non-drinker. With IATs, you can use picture stimuli or word stimuli. For us, we used word stimuli. And one of the things that we really took a lot of time and effort doing was making sure when we were picking out our words that we were careful and we were thinking about what it means to be a drinker or a non-drinker, so words to describe that, that we had a combination of positive and negative words in both, because we didn't want it to be that being a drinker was necessarily a good or bad thing, or that being a non-drinker was necessarily a good or bad thing, right? Because then, in essence, you're confounding your IAT from that standpoint. And so we started developing this implicit measure of drinking identity, and we also developed an explicit measure of drinking identity. And so for an explicit measure, just to remind you again, that explicit measure, explicit processes, these are really the kinds of questions that we ask, where we ask you and we ask you to reflect and think about or introspect about a series of questions. And so there we got lucky, and it turned out folks in the smoking field were ahead of those of us in the alcohol field at the time, and were starting to think about this question of identity. And there was this really lovely scale called the Smoking Self-Concept Scale that really asks these kinds of questions about how much you organize your life about smoking, how much smoking is important to who you are as a person. And we adapted that measure, but for the alcohol domain and for the drinking domain. So at this point, we had what we thought were two reasonable ways to measure the more implicit side of the process using the IET, which is a reaction time measure. And so it doesn't rely on awareness necessarily. And we had our really nice explicit measure of drinking identity so that we could start to see whether or not, in essence, my former student was correct and whether or not we really had missed something in terms of thinking about some cognitive factor that might really be important for drinking. So where we started and where my lab started was really by asking the question of whether or not thinking about yourself as a drinker tells us anything about how much you drink, right? One of the most basic levels. And so we tested this in a cross-sectional study, and we were fortunate enough, we had some grant funding at the time, that we could bring in 300 students into the lab. And we had them complete these implicit and explicit measures of drinking identity, and we could look and see how that related to different self-report measures of drinking. So things like alcohol consumption, alcohol cravings, and how many problems or the kinds of problems people were having with drinking. And so again, we're just starting really simply. We want to know whether or not there's an association between these new measures of drinking identity and these drinking behaviors that we care about. And what we found when we actually ran the study and looked at the data is that there was. There were these really nice positive associations between the implicit measures, so how strongly you identify as a drinker based on the IET, was very significantly correlated with how much people were drinking on a weekly basis, how much they're craving alcohol, and the number of alcohol-related problems they're having. What we also found when we looked at that explicit measure, so that self-report measure of drinking identity, is that also was really nicely correlated with those same outcomes, so how much people are drinking, how much they're craving alcohol, and how many problems they're having. For those of you who are interested from a methodology standpoint, what we typically find when we're looking at implicit and explicit measures is that the implicit measure isn't correlated as strongly as the explicit measure is. Typically, you see correlations around 0.25, 0.3 between an implicit measure and some kind of behavioral outcome, and that's what we were finding in this study. Typically, when you're looking at some kind of self-report measure of something like identity or drinking motives, things like that, you tend to see higher correlations, and that's certainly what we found in this domain. So kind of pulling back for a second, we seem to have some initial evidence that whether or not or how much you think about yourself as a drinker does tell us something about how much you actually drink, so what your behavior is actually doing. So given that evidence, what we wanted to do next was to turn to some more complex questions. What we wanted to understand next was whether or not this construct of identity, whether you measure it implicit or on an explicit level, is really something new or different. And we did this in a couple different ways. The first thing that we wanted to do was to look at whether or not that implicit measure, so the drinking identity IET, whether or not it captured anything different from the explicit measure of drinking identity. So in essence, the question that we wanted to ask, or we were asking, is whether or not it's worth it to administer the IET to measure as a measure of drinking identity. It takes longer to administer an IET. You got to use a computer program. You can't just ask people and do a two-minute questionnaire. And so if you can get the same thing by simply asking people, you might as well just ask them, right? We got to save time. We got to be efficient. We got to save resources. So to test this, what we did is to evaluate both the implicit and explicit measure of drinking identity in these same models. So we're using sets of regression models and looking to see whether or not the implicit and explicit measure, when you put them both in the same model, are they still both significant, right? And if they're both significant, or even if only the implicit measure is significant, it's telling you that it's worth it to put that implicit measure in, right? Because it's capturing something that's unique, something that's distinct. And what we found when we did that is that across all of those outcomes that I was telling you about before, so how much people drink, their alcohol consumption, how much they crave alcohol, how many alcohol problems they have, across all of those different outcomes, both the implicit measure, so the IAT, and the explicit measure, the self-report, they're both contributing. They both predict significantly. So what that was telling us is that it seems like it might be worth it to use that implicit measure. The effect sizes are certainly bigger for explicit measures, but that drinking identity IAT still told you something different from the explicit measure. So it seemed like the implicit and explicit were capturing something a little bit different, which got us excited. But what we also wanted to know after that is whether or not that IAT, so the drinking identity IAT, whether or not that captured anything different from the other implicit measures related to alcohol that are already out there. As I was telling y'all about earlier, I'm late to the party when it comes to doing alcohol research, and we had a whole lot of people, really smart people, thinking about implicit measures of alcohol-related cognitions. There's some nice IATs that have been around for a long time, a number of which developed by a wonderful mentor and collaborator of mine, Reinout Veers, over in Amsterdam. And what we wanted to do was to test and see whether or not this drinking identity IAT, is it capturing anything different from those other IATs that are out there? And so what we did is we, again, similar kind of style from what I'm telling you about before, looked at those same outcomes, so alcohol consumption, alcohol craving, alcohol problems. In this time, what we did is we just focused on the IAT. So we had that drinking identity IAT, and we had a series of other alcohol-related IATs that have been used in the literature before, and we wanted to essentially see, you know, how does the drinking identity IAT stack up? When you're comparing it to these other IATs in the same regression models, does it still predict significantly? Because if it doesn't, what that tells us is that you don't need it. You're covering the same kind of concept by using these other IATs, in which case, you know, kind of party's over on this IAT because we can cover it with the other ones that are already out there. What we found when we did that and looked at that is that, again, across all three outcomes, so drinks per week, alcohol craving, and alcohol problems, is that the drinking identity IAT still predicted significant variance in those outcomes. So what that's telling us, again, is that that drinking identity IAT is contributing something new, something different from what the other IATs measure. So pulling that together, what we're seeing so far kind of in this process of looking at questions related to identity and drinking is that we've got some evidence that how strongly you identify with drinking tells us something about how much you drink. We've also got some preliminary evidence that drinking identity isn't kind of same old, that both the implicit and the explicit measure of identity seem to contribute to predicting drinking outcomes that we care about, and that implicit identity seems to be different from the other implicit alcohol-related cognitions that we've been measuring already. And so that seems pretty darn promising, and it got us interested in knowing whether or not those kinds of findings replicated and extended. So what we did, we were able to essentially ask the same questions and run a very similar study with a colleague and mentor of mine at the University of Houston, Clayton Neighbors, who's worked with me on this research and been incredibly, incredibly giving of his time over the years. And what we found was essentially the same pattern. So we were finding this really nice pattern of effects, even if you're looking at a sample from a different university, different geography, different kind of set of students who attend University of Houston versus University of Washington. We also got the opportunity to ask questions about whether or not these findings extend beyond the college populations. And so we were able to look at this in a large web-based sample. I've gotten to work with Bethany Teachman for a number of years as an anxiety disorders researcher and does clinical applications of implicit measures and implicit processes to anxiety disorders research. And she very graciously let us look at this question through this huge website that she's got called Project Implicit Mental Health. And what we found there in the sample of 11,000 individuals with adults aged 18 to 98, that we see the same pattern. We see that implicit and explicit measures of identity uniquely contribute to predicting drinking outcomes. And this latter question was really important for us to answer because as people started hearing a little bit about these preliminary findings, there are a lot of questions about whether or not these identity-related pieces were really specific to a college-age or young adult population where we know that questions of identity are so important. And that doesn't seem to be the case. There certainly are some evidence that age moderates this effect, but even as you get older, there's still a really nice, tight, positive relationship between implicit measures of identity and explicit measures of identity predicting drinking outcomes. One thing I want to note on the professional development points is that I do think it's important, you know, all the replication kind of crisis issue aside, I do think it's important generally to replicate your findings, try to replicate them from other populations to the degree to which you can, to understand how generalizable your findings are or aren't. And on the relationship end, I think it's also important to do everything you can to develop good relationships with your trainees, right, with the people you collaborate with and the people that you mentor. None of this research that I'm telling you about today is research that I could have done without having those kinds of relationships. And I think this is definitely one of these cases where people talk about paying it forward. And I think it is really important to do that because science is a small field. Addiction science is an even smaller field. These are relationships that are going to be with you throughout your career and really can help set you up and help you make a big impact on the field. So pulling this together for a second, what we've seen so far is that we've seen how strongly you identify with drinking tells us something about how much you drink. We've seen that drinking identity doesn't seem to be the old thing, whether you're talking about implicit and explicit measures of identity or whether you're talking about the implicit measures of identity relative to these other implicit measures of alcohol. And we're also seeing that the findings replicate to other university samples and that it's replicating to large samples that include non-college students and older adults. The last kind of question that I'm going to tell you about today in terms of this line of research is to really start to consider this question about whether or not how much you think about drinking or identify with drinking, how much does that tell you about what your future behavior might be? So in essence, does drinking identity kind of predict the future in any way? Because all of the work that I've told you about so far is cross-sectional, really at this point had almost no understanding about how these patterns extended over time. So the data that starts to address these questions comes from one of my R01s, and as part of that particular grant, what we're doing or did is we followed a sample of 500 undergraduate students who were in their first to second year of college, and we followed them for 2 years. And we picked that time frame because it's a time frame when there tends to be a lot of change in drinking, and we assessed a number of cognitive risk factors, including measures of drinking identity. And so one of the things that we really wanted to understand is what happens when we look over time and we're controlling for current behavior. So in essence, can we show or is it possible that drinking identity can predict changes in important outcomes over time? What we found is when we looked at implicit and explicit measures of drinking identity simultaneously, so these same kinds of regression models when we're looking at the contribution of both implicit identity and explicit identity, we are finding that they both predict changes in alcohol consumption, alcohol problems, and risk of alcohol use disorders. So it seems like the higher your drinking identity is, there is a relationship that it's predicting increases in alcohol consumption, increases in alcohol problems, and increases in risk in alcohol use disorders. We also wanted to understand, because it's pretty unusual to have IATs assessed more than one or two times, and in this particular study, we actually had 8 different assessments of drinking identity IAT and 8 different assessments of 2 other alcohol-related IATs. And we wanted to understand kind of how far out can these IATs predict changes in drinking to really get a sense of how useful the IATs are, because again, they are more cumbersome to administer versus a self-report questionnaire. What we found when we looked at the identity-related IAT relative to these 2 other alcohol-related IATs is that the identity-related IAT actually predicted out the longest, and it could actually predict changes in drinking out over the course of the entire study, so going out as far as 21 months, which is the full duration of the study. The other 2 IATs that we were looking at, alcoholic site and alcohol approach, IETs, they couldn't predict as far. They predict pretty well in the beginning, but then they fall out over time.
Oh, wow.
So that was one of the other things that we saw. I focused a lot about how identity is doing relative to other IETs and how the implicit and explicit measure are doing relative to one another. What I haven't talked about yet, and another kind of area of research that we've been playing around with in the last year or so, is also trying to understand, well, how does identity fare relative to other explicit cognitive factors? Because there are all kinds of really, really important cognitive factors related to drinking that have been part of the literature for a very long time that are used as intervention targets, and we didn't really know much about that. So we recently published a study where we were looking at how does identity do relative to social drinking norms, alcohol outcome expectancies, and drinking motives. And again, kind of the key question that we're wanting to ask is, you know, in essence, is drinking identity giving us something new or different relative to these other explicit measures? Because these other explicit measures are great and important. And so is this, again, anything new or different? And, you know, briefly, what we found when we looked at how implicit and explicit identity did relative to those measures, it does seem to predict unique variance when you're comparing it to drinking norms, when you compare it to alcohol outcome expectancies, when you compare it to drinking motives. As you'd expect, and as I've talked about previously, that explicit measure does a better job of it. The effect sizes are bigger, and that's what we find across pretty much any domain in which you're using implicit and explicit measures simultaneously. So we are finding that, you know, implicit and explicit identity do seem to predict something new or different relative to the other explicit cognitive factors. So we don't think that identity is simply the same thing as an outcome expectancy or the same thing as a drinking motive. The last piece that I'll just give you a little teaser about, we are in the midst right now of working on analyses that are looking at changes over time from the standpoint of, do changes in identity predict changes in drinking, and do changes in drinking predict changes in identity? And so typically we think about that. Very commonly you might assess that in a cross-like panel model. And so currently we're testing some cross-like panel models to look at how changes of in identity predict changes in drinking and vice versa. We're looking right now at the implicit measure of drinking identity, and we've got some really nice preliminary evidence that we are seeing that changes in identity are predicting changes in drinking, and that changes in drinking are predicting changes in identity. And so, you know, so certainly I would suspect that identity is a marker of how much you drink, but we've also got some preliminary evidence that it might be a mechanism as well. And it's early stages with this, but that's where we are at the moment. So kind of pulling this together, what we're seeing so far with drinking identity is it does seem to be able to predict behavior. It doesn't seem to be the same thing that we've been measuring in other ways. The findings do seem to replicate and extend, and we are getting some nice preliminary information that drinking identity can, in essence, predict the future, that it can tell us something about what you're likely to do next or what individuals are likely to do next. And so that's really what led me to the title of this talk, which is, I do think it's important to put the I back in drinking. I think it's important for us to put self-concept and thinking about identity-related associations, whether measured on an implicit or an explicit level, that should become and get integrated back into our models of alcohol use and misuse. And pulling back to where I started in terms of thinking about the treatment gap, part of why my lab and I've been so excited about this work is that not only does identity seem to be a novel construct from the standpoint of we're not measuring it already, we're also not really targeting it in treatments right now. We may be getting at it indirectly in some of the work that we're doing, but we're not directly kind of targeting it. So it suggests that we might have an additional target that we could go after as we're developing treatments. And so some of my work going forward is working towards figuring out ways that we can manipulate identity or target identity so that ideally we can build some brief standalone treatments or aspects of a treatment that could get folded into existing treatments that are targeting identity, with the idea that we could either augment the existing treatments or have something else that's brief, ideally could be done without going to a therapist's office that could help us bridge the treatment gap. So that's part of where my work's going to be going over time. And I would say, you know, kind of ultimately throughout these pieces, it's really thinking about wanting to reduce the gap and thinking about ways that we can ultimately make people's lives better, which I think for most of us is the reason that we got into this field to begin with. And so with that, I'm going to stop here and figure out what kinds of questions I can answer.
That was absolutely fantastic. It was really compelling work. Now, do you mind if I jump in and ask a quick question?
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking a little bit about how your work maps onto the work I do, and just quickly, you know, I do a lot of lab-based Curie activity paradigm research with folks with alcohol use disorder. So you know, I'm also a psychophysiologist as well as a clinical psychologist. So, you know, I'm very much interested in the disconnect between autonomic arousal upon exposure to alcohol cues and subjective ratings of arousal. And we find with folks with alcohol use disorder, they're often not very good self-reporters of arousal. So we'll show them images of alcohol and they say, oh, yeah, it's not really doing it for me. But in terms of like autonomic arousal, there's clearly a lot going on. And so, you know, you're telling us that both implicit and explicit measures are very good predictors of drinking behavior. And it sounds like that holds true in college samples. And I was just wondering, in folks with alcohol use disorder, maybe you haven't gotten there yet, but I was wondering even if you had any ideas about this, would the implicit measures be more robust predictors
right.
of alcohol use in people who are further down the line with more severe alcohol-related problems?
What a fabulous, fabulous question. Yeah, and I'm incredibly grateful to an anonymous reviewer on a theory paper that I published with some colleagues recently who raised this exact question and pointed us to a full line of research that was, in essence, talking about deficits in self-awareness that come up, right, with folks who are farther out with more severe and more chronic kinds of problems. I think these are really important questions, and I'm really lucky that I'm getting to work with Kevin Montes, who's a fabulous postdoc at UNM and who's interested in these kinds of questions in more severe populations. And it would be really interesting, and we're hoping we're going to get to answer some of these questions, because the honest answer is we don't know at this point.
Right, but it's on the radar. That's the next step.
Yeah, it is on the radar, and I think there really is this question about, because the implicit measure doesn't necessarily rely on self-awareness, is it possible that you might find that it's predicting better? You know, do you start to see a flip where maybe the effect sizes get larger there?
Exactly.
I don't know if we will or won't, but it sure will be fun to find out.
Yeah, well, I look forward to hearing more about that work.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is really, really exciting stuff. I think to piggyback a little bit on David's comment, I think it's really interesting. Like if you're working in like addiction recovery, for instance, like when people come into treatment and they kind of like are exporting their self out of this kind of context for which they become really comfortable, whether they like it or not is a different story, but they know who they are and like what their role is there. Yeah. And in recovery, they have like this huge void kind of missing there. And I think that like, for instance, like, mutual help groups like AA, for instance, kind of give them a new identity to kind of take the mantle of like, I'm in recovery now.
Right.
And so I'm really interested to see how some of this kind of develops in by way, like kind of like a precision medicine approach by which we can kind of import some of these things that you're doing and kind of turn them into malleable factors that are targets for intervention. I think that's really, really exciting work.
Yeah, and one of the things that's been really interesting to me is that when you look at the literature from the vantage of the dual process models, you don't see identity being talked about, right? I've, in the last, I would say, 5 years or so, within folks who are working in the recovery literature and really in the treatment literature, there's more work on identity than I realized. And so it's been really interesting to become alerted to that when you get to spend around and play in some different literatures that you don't naturally read and look at.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got some wonderful colleagues in the UK and in Australia who are looking at questions of identity related to recovery and have written some wonderful theory papers in the last year or two about social identities as being pathways in and out of addiction. And where they're a little different from me is that I really think about identity based on my own training as much more of an individual difference factor. But these folks are much more trained as social psychologists who really emphasize like group processes, right, and the importance of the group. And so I think to Noah, to sort of your point about this idea of a community that comes up often as part of like AA or a recovery center, or a treatment center that you might go to. And they really looked at, in essence, this development of a novel identity, right? So being a you know, someone who's in recovery or a recovering addict versus an addict, right? And how that seems to be some preliminary evidence that that's also predictive of better outcomes. And so it's largely qualitative work, so I think it'll be really interesting as we figure out ways to extend that. And then also then what does it mean? How do you help facilitate a different type of identity and really think about different identities can be, to quote the groups over there, pathways into and out of addiction.
Yeah, I think those within-person changes, right, as a function of kind of context, I think of that interaction, if you will, I think really kind of opens up a whole, kind of blossoms a whole new area of research, especially as we're thinking about it maybe as depending on how NIH and things move forward with kind of the precision medicine approach and kind of the one-size-fits-all doesn't fit all the time. How come it works for this, for these folks and not for those folks? Maybe they're different on the on their level of, you know, implicit drinking identity, and that's why, you know, having this new recovery identity works for this person versus that. I think that's going to be some really interesting work coming out in the future, especially as I kind of think about some of David's work and kind of the intersection between the three of us. I do a lot of within-person differences, kind of event-level associations, and so I think about how that identity kind of shifts over time and how that might be a factor. And I'm really glad to hear that that's kind of the future of some of your work is these trajectory change differences in those cross-panel models. That's really exciting stuff.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. Now, I was getting towards the end there. I thought maybe we'd quickly open it up to the floor in case there was anybody on the call who had a question.
Hi, this is Ty Yanishka. How you doing?
Good, how are you?
Doing good. I'm a graduate student right now, finishing up my dissertation in addiction psychology. I was just wondering, now listening to all this stuff with the implicit identity, it seems to me like I'm a big fan of the trans-theoretical model of change.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like there's some sort of correlations here. I'm just wondering if you've looked at any of that where they're in their, you know, when they're in a stage, when they're in one of the stages, how that correlates to what they're identifying with, what their implicit identification, if there might be something with that, or is that something that you think would be further research somewhere? Have you guys thought about any of that?
Yeah. So if I paraphrase it this way, tell me if I'm kind of getting a little bit of the question. It's almost like to what extent might a particular stage of change moderate or mediate the relationship?
Well, yeah, I was just wondering if you did anything with that, or if you think there might be some sort of correlation. I mean, just on the outside, not like you've done anything with that. I mean, it seems like there's some sort of relationship there, possibly.
Yeah, I would say it's a great question, and I think we don't know the answer to that. Little bit, one of our earlier studies had some measures of readiness to change and looking at that as a potential moderator of a different manipulation that we were doing related to some other questions. And we weren't finding great evidence there, but I think, you know, to your point, thinking about the trans-theoretical model, thinking about what it is that motivates people for change, certainly identity would be related to that. And I think it's some of the questions that are coming probably in the next wave of research and ideally being done by folks other than me who have access to different kinds of populations. Predominantly, I end up looking at young adult populations of what I've got the easiest access to these days. And thankfully, I've got some really wonderful colleagues who have links to more treatment kinds of populations.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't want to get too far away from your stuff.
Nope.
Just as a new guy,
yeah.
You know, getting in there, I just wanted to hear some more from the professionals, what their thoughts on that.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. Thank you for that.
You got it.
All right. Well, it looks like we're right up against it at 1 o'clock right now. So if there's any other questions, I guess we'll bid everybody adieu, and thanks for everybody for joining the call. And if you have any questions about this kind of stuff, we're going to post the podcast on the website, and then we're also going to have some company articles that Kristen has been very gracious in providing us with if you want to look into further things like that. And Kristen, would you be willing to answer some questions if people got stuff that they didn't get a chance to jump on here with? Would that be okay?
Oh, absolutely. If folks have questions, you're more than welcome to email me and get in touch with me. I'd be happy to do so.
Excellent.
Wonderful.
Okay.
Wonderful.
So thanks, everybody, for joining us. And
yeah, thanks so much. Really, great to hear you. Really good talk.
Oh, thanks.
Great, thank you.
Well, thanks so much for the opportunity, and I hope everybody has a good rest of their day.
Yes, thank you so much. Have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.